Hi, welcome to the latest edition of the Lab Medicine podcast series. My name is Kelly Swales. I'm the web editor for Lab Medicine magazine. And today I have with me Dr. Gander, who's going to talk about carbapenem-resistant enterobacteriaceae.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I am a professor at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. I am also a director of the Clinical Microbiology Laboratory at St. Paul University Hospital and at Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas, Texas. I'd like to start by giving you a little background about Enterobacteriaceae in general, and then you can better appreciate the problem with this antibiotic resistance. Enterobacteriaceae, they're a family of gram-negative bacteria that are normal inhabitants of your human gastrointestinal tract. So every one of us has these Enterobacteriaceae, and they're very common human pathogens, especially Escherichia coli, which you may have heard of, cause a wide range of infections, both in healthcare settings like hospitals and long-term care institutions, and in the community. The types of infections you might see are urinary tract related, like cystitis, pyelonephritis, septicemia, pneumonia, peritonitis, even something serious like meningitis or device-associated bacteremias, usually with IV catheter associations. And these Enterobacteriaceae, they spread very easily through carriage on your hands and also in contaminated food and water, so they're everywhere. Since the early 2000s, gram-negative rods producing enzymes have been spreading throughout the United States. Now, these are different enzymes. These are extended-spectrum beta-lactamase-producing organisms, which hydrolyze almost all of the beta-lactam antibiotics except for the carbapenems. So when these ESBLs became more common, it led to an increased use of the carbapenem antibiotics for these difficult-to-treat infections in the healthcare settings. And sometimes this was the only therapeutic option for a patient. So what are the carbapenem antibiotics? The most common are ertapenem, imipenem, meropenem, and doropenem. The downstream consequence of using these carbapenems for these gram-negative rods that produce these other enzymes was that it led to an increase in carbapenem-resistant gram-negative rods. So you're just developing these superbacteria that are resistant to almost all antibiotics. And also, these CRE bacteria carried resistance genes to other classes of antibiotics. So this is a big problem. That means you're not just seeing bacteria that are resistant to carbapenems, but they might be resistant to aminoglycosides, fluoroquinolones, the list goes on. So as a consequence, there's been the creation of a generation of bacteria that are resistant to nearly all available antibiotics. And as a side note, the Infectious Disease Society of America is very concerned about this, and they've started this Bad Bugs, No Drug campaign to encourage the development of new therapeutics to treat these bacteria. There's currently very little new antibiotic development and little financial incentive for companies to pursue antibiotic research. Most of the new antibiotics that have been developed were directed against gram-positive bacteria, not gram-negative rods. Why are CRE potentially more important than other antibiotic-resistant bugs? We've heard a lot about them in the news lately. Well, one of the important factors is that if you develop a CRE bloodstream infection, the mortality rate is significantly higher than developing bacteremia with a carbapenem-susceptible bacteria. The mortality rates go as high as 50% of patients who develop these bloodstream infections will die. Also, what makes them very important is that the resistance to other classes of antibiotics in addition to carbapenems, and that these CRE bacteria can spread very rapidly and have the potential to move from hospitalized patients into the community. One of the latest concerns, too, is the spread into the pediatric population. There are fewer treatment options for children than adults, so that's concerning. And this resistance is transmissible. It spreads from one type of bacteria to another. And right now, we're seeing sporadic cases and outbreaks worldwide. So how big is this CRE problem in the U.S.? CDC recently combined the data from three different groups to determine the number of institutions in the U.S. that had at least one healthcare-associated CRE infection. And they found that there were 42 states that had at least one positive patient case, that it was more common in the Northeast. And what they saw was they started this survey in 2001 and then resurveyed in 2011 and 12. And starting in 2001, only 1.2% of the institutions demonstrated CRE bacteria. But by 2011, it had increased fourfold to 4.2%. Now, it's still very uncommon to find CRE bacteria in most acute care hospitals. Only about 4% of them have bacteria that have this type of resistance. It's more frequent to see it in long-term care facilities like nursing homes, institutions that take care of ventilator-associated or ventilator-dependent patients. About 18% of those long-term care facilities have documented case of CRE infection. Now, the majority of these CRE bacteria have been isolated from the urine, so primarily urinary tract infections. But what's really scary is that 10% of them have been isolated from blood. And again, that 40 to 50% mortality rate is daunting. The CRE strains, and I've talked about the Enterobacteriaceae family, and there's a number of genera in that family, but the most common species is Klebsiella species to have these CRE traits. E. coli and Enterobacter have also become more common over time. So who is at risk to develop CRE colonization and infection? Well, in adults, those that are critically ill have had a recent organ or stem cell transplant, patients on mechanical ventilation, or have had extended stay in healthcare facilities, or have had prior exposure to antibiotics, particularly fluoroquinolones, cephalosporins, and, as you expect, carbapenems. CRE is very uncommon in children. There was meta-analysis of data from six different studies worldwide, and they found what was common among these children is that they were usually very young, with a median age of 1 year, and they were critically ill. They had other conditions that predisposed them to infection, had indwelling devices, surgery, immunosuppressive agents, and of course, prior antibiotic use. The good news about children is that the mortality rate is much lower if they develop a bacteremia, only about 10% compared to adults at 40 to 50%. But the bad news is that the effective antibiotic therapy for children is much more limited. There's fewer antibiotics approved for use in children. So how did the bacteria become resistant to carbapenems? Well, there are two primary mechanisms. There's the production of enzymes that specifically inactivate carbapenems, and those are the carbapenemases. Or there's been descriptions of a combined effect of overproduction of other enzymes, beta-lactamases like ESBLs or AMP-C cephalosporinases, and concomitant decrease in the permeability of the bacterial outer membrane. And this permeability change or changes is due to porons. Porons are either altered or lost. They are a structure which forms a channel through the bacterial cell membrane that allows selective uptake of essential nutrients and other compounds, including antibiotics. So if you lose a poron or it's altered in some way, then you might be able to stop the entry of the antibiotic into the bacterial cell. The most common porons are AMP-F and AMP-C, which have been noted to be changed or lost. Now, strains that become resistant by producing the carbapenemases are the most dangerous to our community. And this is because the resistance can be easily passed from bacteria to bacteria because the resistance genes are located on mobile genetic elements, usually plasmids. There are three classes of these carbapenemase enzymes that are probably most important for sustaining this resistance to carbapenems: AMBLER A, B, and D. Class A includes the most common type of carbapenemases. You may have heard of KPCs, Klebsiella pneumoniae carbapenemases, and at least in the U.S., these were first described in 1996 in North Carolina. But these KPC enzymes are found worldwide. Even in the U.S., there's regional differences in the type of KPC enzymes. There are KPC 1 through 12. So depending on whether you're in Los Angeles or you are in Rhode Island, you may find different types of KPCs. The carbapenemase enzyme is encoded on a plasmid. So again, it's transmissible from bacteria to bacteria. And it inactivates penicillins, cephalosporins, cefamycins, ACE trienem, and carbapenems. And for these class A enzymes, they can be inhibited, at least in vitro, in the lab, by clavulanate and tazobactam, which are beta-lactamase inhibitors. And the class A carbapenemases have been seen in other members of the Enterobacteriaceae family besides Klebsiella. That's just the most common. There are other class A enzymes besides KPC. There's SME, IMI, GES, and NMCA, but these are less common in the U.S. So again, for class A, you think of KPCs. The next group, the class B metallo-beta-lactamases, have been in the news lately. An example is New Delhi metallo-beta-lactamases, also called NDM1, and they were first reported and described in Sweden in 2007. They were recovered from a patient in Sweden who had previously been hospitalized in New Delhi, India. That's how it acquired the name. And these strains have since appeared in the U.S. by about 2010. They're still rare here, but we are starting to see them. Predominantly, though, they're on the Indian subcontinent, Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, and also in the Middle East. These NDM enzymes are different. They get their name metallo because they're zinc-independent enzymes. And they hydrolyze, again, in vitro in the lab, all penicillins, cephalosporins, and carbapenems, except for ACE trienem. So they're a little different than KPCs. And unlike KPCs, the activity of the enzyme cannot be inhibited by the beta-lactamase inhibitors. The enzyme activity can be inhibited by EDTA, but right now there's no nationwide approved laboratory method for demonstrating this inhibition and identifying these metallo-beta-lactamases. The biggest concern is that these NDM strains can carry resistance genes to other antibiotics, essentially in some cases becoming resistant to almost all or most antibiotics available for therapy. Characterized NDM strains have been a mixture of plasmid and chromosomal encoded resistance genes. And some laboratories have detected other enzymatic resistance, carbapenemases like also AMP-C, cephalosporinases, and resistance to aminoglycosides, macrolides, rifampicin, and sulfamethoxazole. There are other beta-metallolactamases, including VIM, which is Verona integrin-encoded MBLs, and IMP enzymes. But again, NDM has captured the interest of the public and is seen most often in the United States. Finally, there is class D carbapenemases, OXA48 and 181, and they're named OXA because their oxacillin hydrolyzing ability. And again, they're transmitted by plasmids, but they're not seen commonly in the U.S., primarily in the Mediterranean, Europe, and Latin America. They can be found in the Enterobacteriaceae family, but are more common in Pseudomonas aeruginosa and Acinetobacter. They generally do not hydrolyze extended spectrum cephalosporins like ceftazidime and ceftriaxone. So all of these enzymes have unique characteristics. The ones that we have heard about the most and that have been seen in the U.S., though, are the KPCs and the NDM enzymes. So can the laboratory detect these strains? I'm going to give you a qualified yes. Why is that? Well, some of these carbapenemase-producing gram-negative rods will actually test susceptible in the lab because they're expressing such a low-level resistance in vitro to the carbapenems, especially meropenem and imipenem. These strains will act like resistant bacteria in the patient. The patient will not respond to the carbapenem therapy, but in the lab, they'll look susceptible. So what could the laboratories do to increase the sensitivity of detection of these strains? Well, there have been many things, many changes. First, you could lower the minimum inhibitory concentration, the MIC breakpoints, for detection of resistance, make it more sensitive. So in 2010, the Clinical Laboratory Standards Institute lowered the breakpoints. There's another problem, though. These new CLSI breakpoints did not match the FDA breakpoints that were being used by the automated susceptibility systems. And the majority of the U.S. labs use these automated systems. So to use the new breakpoints, the labs had to perform in-house validations that required extensive effort. And some laboratories have not been able to do that, perhaps don't have the personnel. Another problem, some of these commercial panels used by the automated systems do not have a full component of dilutions of all the carbapenems. So they don't have these lower MIC concentrations that can be used for these new breakpoints. So what can a lab do? Well, they can perform in-house validation of the new breakpoints, or they can use a carbapenem on the panel with the lowest dilution range as a marker of carbapenem resistance, and then follow up with phenotypic tests. There are some phenotypic tests that are available for confirmation of resistance. One of those is the modified Hodge test, which is an auger plate test for detection of CRE. It does detect most carbapenemase-producing strains, but the metallo-beta-lactamases like NDM may be negative or weakly positive in this test, which is a problem. What you do is a plate is inoculated with a lawn of E. coli that's susceptible to carbapenems. You drop either an ertapenem or meropenem disc on the bacterial lawn with the expectation that there will be a wide zone of inhibition around the antibiotic. Then the suspect carbapenem-resistant strain is applied to the plate in a straight line of inoculum toward the antibiotic disc. If the suspect strain produces a carbapenemase, the enzyme will diffuse in the auger and inactivate the antibiotic around the line of inoculum. And you'll see an enhanced growth of the E. coli strain at the intersection of the straight line inoculum and the zone of inhibition in a cloverleaf shape. Another approach in the laboratory is molecular characterization of the beta-lactamase or BLA genes, although this is not something that's readily available in most routine laboratories. So laboratories are still evolving. There was a recent hospital outbreak of New Delhi metallo-beta-lactamase producing Klebsiella pneumoniae in Denver, Colorado, and it was reported in the MMWR in August 2012. There were 3 patients who developed infections and 5 additional patients who became colonized. And these were really bad bugs because the isolates were resistant to all antimicrobials tested with the exception of tigecycline and colistin. And to date, this is the largest cluster of NDM in the U.S. There have been 16 other isolates previously reported, but this is the largest cluster at a single hospital. So what can healthcare institutions do? One action is to follow the CDC guidance for control of CRE. CDC has published a 2012 CRE toolkit and has developed a definition for CRE. Their definition is that an enteric gram-negative rod is non-susceptible to one of the following, doripenem, meropenem, or any imipenem, and is resistant to all of the following third-generation cephalosporins tested, ceftriaxone, cefotaxime, or ceftazidime. Also, they recommend core measures like excellent hand hygiene, contact precautions for colonized or infected patients in acute care settings, minimizing device use like catheters, patient and staff cohorting, and lab notification of clinical and infection prevention staff if they isolate a CRE or suspect CRE. And finally, robust antimicrobial stewardship programs. CDC has also recommended CRE screening of stool, rectal, or perirectal cultures for patients in certain high-risk settings, and regional surveillance to determine the number of CRE cases in a particular area. The U.S. continues to see sporadic cases and clusters of CRE infections, but institutions that have used these CDC guidelines have been able to stop the spread of CRE in their institutions. So there is hope. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gander, for joining us today and telling us everything that there is to know about CREs. I know I learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners did too. Thanks so much.